So on this Sunday morning, all across the country, 20 Unitarian congregations are starting to engage in the theme of simplicity, what it means to be simple, live a simple life. And across 20 congregations, we will all be talking about it, reflecting on it, reading our packets, engaging in spiritual activities, and wrestling with questions on what it means to be a people of simplicity. And when I began to think about what that meant, I thought of David Thoreau. And I first heard about him through a talk given by the Reverend Patrick O'Neill, a Unitarian Universalist minister at a Family Elliott camp. And I don't remember, Donna, if you were there when Patrick O'Neill, he's a big man, and it was Winter Elliott, and we were worried about him falling on the ice. And he talked about the life of Thoreau and his retreat into Walden Pond. He spoke about Thoreau in such a manner that I became really curious about him. In fact, I was kind of hooked. When I realized that it was Thoreau who had penned the reading that we just read, To Live Deliberately, I had to find out more about him and what drove him to describe life in such an odd way. I wondered what he saw in the world that caused him to look at life, to front only the essential facts of life, to live deep and to suck the marrow out of life and to reduce it to its lowest terms. I wondered what he meant when he says he wants to learn what life teaches and not discover at death's door that he had not yet lived. So to put it into context, in 1840, Boston was a bustling seaport, a cosmopolitan center with a large and widely mobile population. It was one of the world's wealthiest international trading ports, exporting products like rum, fish, salt, and tobacco, and fortunes were rising. And what a time it was to be alive then. Amidst all the busyness of the ports of Boston had going for it at that time, there was also tremendous exchange of ideas. There were writers like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and Julia Ward Howe, among many others. Historians such as George Bancroft and Henry Adams were there as well. And that's not all. We get to add in William Ellery Channing and Ralph Waldo Emerson as theologians of the time. It was remarked that in Boston at that time, it was impossible to shoot a gun without managing to kill an author or two of a two-volume publication. And into all of this walks our friend Henry David Thoreau. His friend Nathaniel Hawthorne describes him as ugly as sin, long-nosed, queer-mouthed, with an uncouth and rustic, though courteous, manners, corresponding very well with such an exterior. But his ugliness is of an honest and agreeable fashion and becomes him much better than beauty. I think we'd all like to have that said about us. Thoreau followed Emerson's philosophy, known as transcendentalism. It held that an ideal spiritual state is beyond the physical and empirical, and one that achieves insight through personal intuition as opposed to religious doctrine. As well, according to the transcendentalists, nature is an outward sign of an inward spirit, expressing the radical correspondence of visible things and human thoughts, as Emerson wrote in his publication in 1836. It was evident to everyone, including Channing, that Thoreau needed to concentrate and focus more on his writing. And in March of 1845, Channing told Thoreau, "Go upon that land and build yourself a hut, and there begin the grand process of devouring yourself alive. I see no other alternative, no other hope for you." 2 months later, Thoreau embarked on a 2-year experiment in simple living. On July 4th, he moved into a small, built house on land owned by Emerson in a forest around the shores of Walden Pond. The house was in a pasture and a woodlot of 14 acres and located only 1.5 miles from Emerson's family home. He wasn't way out there in the boondocks. He was actually fairly close to civilization. And he went out into the woods because he wished to live deliberately. Even though he spent his time living in this tiny house in the woods, he wasn't cut off from his friends or civilization. He'd frequently walk into Concord to shop for supplies. Friends would stop by and visit with him and bring him food. He was not much of a cook, couldn't look after himself much. His mother even came and did his laundry for him. I know. So don't think he had a hard life out there in the woods. He came out of this experience, though, much more in touch with nature, and much to his surprise, having a greater respect for civilization and the need for balance in our lives. He made deliberate decisions about his lifestyle from that point on. He figured out how much he wanted to work and then constructed his lifestyle around his earnings. His book, Walden, or Life in the Woods, contained reflections of human development based on the cycles of the seasons in the year and what we would now call voluntary simplicity. To live deliberately. To live deliberately. On the one hand, these words sound like something that we can all do. Most of us get up in the morning with a to-do list. I know I do. I make it every morning. Or some way of keeping track of what needs to be done to get through the day. We all wake up, have our breakfast, read, respond to email, rush off to work, or start our personal project or volunteer work. Some of us need to get children off to where they need to be at any given time throughout the day. And once we finally get to work, we're deliberate about fulfilling our obligations to our employee so that we can make sure that there's enough money in the bank to pay those bills. We're deliberate about maintaining our relationships with our loved ones because it shows we care. We're deliberate about making sure that we're prepared to take on any commitments that we make at work, at home, to ourselves. And in the background of all of that, there exists this subtext that we all live with. And it has its being in the messages that we receive constantly about how to dress, what to eat, what to drive, what to listen to, and how to live. The messages are so constant that it's sometimes hard to listen, to discern what's really authentically us and what's manufactured by others. Never mind just being hard to listen to, sometimes we forget to take the time to listen. We're too busy responding to the performance-based atmosphere of consumer culture at the expense of becoming a better self. So when I take the time to listen, and I mean to really listen to the words of Henry David Thoreau in our reading this morning, the busyness of the day seems to melt away, disappear. His words speak to a much more deliberate way to live on this precious planet with this one precious life we have. Mary Oliver asked the question in her poem, The Summer Day, tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one and precious life? It is how we choose to live our one life that gives honor and due respect to the people that have come before us. Thoreau invites us, actually I think he commands us, to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, for living is too dear. The forest invites us to be open to life as the natural world is around us, to be open to each and every moment as it arrives, just as the flowers and the plants and the trees are. We need to learn how to reawaken our senses to the surroundings. In reflecting on this reading, I became curious as to how Canadians spent their time. Do we have enough time to be able to be open to the world around us in a way that allows us to live life authentically, as Thoreau calls us to do? Now, you're going to find that what my research is not all that surprising. Despite years of warnings about striking work-life balance, Canadians are deeper in the rut than ever before. Almost two-thirds of us are working more than 45 hours a week, 50% more than two decades ago. Work weeks are rigid, with flex time arrangements dropping by about a third in the last 10 years. And to top it all off, only 23% of working Canadians are highly satisfied with life. And that's half as many as in 1991. Somehow, I don't think this is the life that Thoreau is talking about. And Jay McDaniel, in his book, Living from the Center, Spirituality in an Age of Consumerism, offers us some helpful perspectives. What was just beginning in Thoreau's time, a modern consumer marketplace, gives rise to one of the biggest problems facing all living beings, including the Earth today. McDaniel compares our current day attitudes towards consumerism as an unofficial corporate-sponsored world religion, where one-fifth of the population overconsumes to the point that we are suffering from environmental degradation and community disintegration. McDaniel's research informs us that overconsumers, now pay attention, I'm going to give you a bunch of figures here. Overconsumers consume approximately, now overconsumers are that one-fifth of the population I'm talking about. They consume approximately 40% of its fresh water, 60% of its fertilizers, 75% of its energy, 80% of its paper, 85% of aluminum. He calls on us in the first world to begin to craft a new way of living that is simpler and more satisfying, and dare I say, more deliberate. This is what Thoreau was talking about 150 years ago. McDaniel offers some suggestions and a way through, and he is writing from a Christian Buddhist perspective and suggests that allowing ourselves to surrender, to open and pay attention to what occurs within, allows us to get in touch with the mystery deep within our heart of creation and in our own lives. I think what he means is that the choice is always available for us to step into a greater connection with what we call the interdependent web. We just need to slow ourselves down and observe. He offers four steps. The first is to acknowledge a need to live differently in the world, to begin to make our choices from a place of wisdom and compassion. The second is to become aware of the subconscious and conscious choices we make in our everyday lives. And we do this by beginning to reframe what success, money, and status are. Remember Thoreau's decision to decide about how much he wanted to work and then to craft a lifestyle around that income. The third is to cultivate those activities that allow us to be open and to observe what is happening in the world and to allow it to touch us. And the last step involves a practice of engaging in a spiritual discipline and, perhaps more importantly, regular offering of time, energy, and action to the service of others. Unitarian Universalist minister Karen Anderson puts it this way: We're called to find what breaks our heart and then to find where that heartbreak intersects with the needs of the world and begin to act on it. The interdependent web holds not only our joy and our delight in the world, but recognition of despair, suffering, and tragedy that life holds. Patrick O'Neill, remember him? He's the one that introduced me to Thoreau. Feels that the biggest lesson that Thoreau gave us was the balance of retreat and being active in the world. And today we need that more than ever. There is a time to retreat, to reflect, to observe, to notice within what the next steps towards wholeness are in our world. And there is a time to look outward into the world and to begin to take action. Patrick's challenge to us then is to become known as the congregation that filled a need within the community. And you have done that in your work with the refugees. Thank you. Thank you for that very deep work. In order to do more of that, we need to be willing to step into and get at the whole meanness of life and to publish its meanness to the world. Unitarian Universalists affirm that we are connected by an interconnected web. This web can be found within and without, in the deep listening to the silence, and in the joyful laughter of infants, in the still small hours of the night on a hill, looking up at a myriad of stars, and in the eyes of a homeless person sitting in the door as well. Thoreau's words call to us to pay attention to all of life, not just the parts that can be wrapped up in a pretty bow. He calls to us to engage in life at every possible moment, for we are the ones that can turn this world around and build a new way. Blessed be. May it be so.